from KLW News in San Francisco. This is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Oh, Redwood City, California.
Hayward?
Near Richmond, Richmond District, kind of.
I'm from Concord.
Martinez.
Hercules.
I'm from Marina, California.
SF State, wherever that is.
Coming up, we're getting set to roll across the new eastern span of the Bay Bridge. Today, we'll meet some of the men who built it.
Well, you know, they call us Cowboys of the Sky.
Then we'll revisit the original opening nearly 77 years ago.
The largest, longest, and greatest completed highway bridge in the world.
And we'll hear the amazing story of a different suspension bridge that failed.
In a 40-mile-an-hour gale, the center span weaves like a ribbon in a swinging twist that you wouldn't believe possible as the bridge gyrates like a nightmare high above the river, twisting, turning, curling.
We're crossing time and space with this unabridged version of Cross Currents. The Bay Bridge's new eastern span will open in about 2 weeks. That means a new view for drivers of the 270,000 vehicles that cross it every day.
It is the workhorse. It carries more traffic than all the other bridges combined in the Bay Area.
That's retired Bay Bridge spokesman Greg Bayall.
The money raised from the tolls go to fix all the other bridges. You know, it's just one thing after another.
Today we're considering this singular creation, and we're going to start with the people entrusted to make the Bay Area's new signature span last. These are not members of your average construction crew. They are iron workers, highly skilled tradesmen who construct the massive metal structures that define our city skylines. KALW's Isabel Angel met three iron workers who've helped build the new Bay Bridge. She spoke with them at their union headquarters in San Francisco.
The first thing you should know about iron workers is that they don't make things out of iron, like horseshoes. They're builders. Iron workers from Local 377 built the Golden Gate Bridge, the Transamerica Tower, and the Bank of America skyscraper right here in San Francisco. Today, the union's biggest and most eye-catching project is the new Bay Bridge's signature suspension span. The huge white tower and cables that reach over 500 feet into the sky. The second thing you should know about iron workers is that they're pretty ballsy.
You know, we're 100 feet in the air, you know, doing stuff that needs to be done.
Matthew Cochran serves as the current job site steward on the Bay Bridge.
You know, if we all stopped each time we cut ourselves or thought we hurt ourselves really bad, the job would still be only halfway done.
Stephen Batiste was a former job site steward.
Well, you know, they call us Cowboys of the Sky.
And Jerry Caballa Jr. was a foreman on the project. All three men have spent a good part of the last 5 years working for American Bridge Floor, the contractor for the self-anchored suspension. The job is winding down. There's 44 people on the bridge right now, including Cochran. But at the construction's peak in 2010, up to 110 workers could be out on the bridge at one time. Caballa Jr. explains their first job in 2008 was actually building a temporary bridge. The span has just a single suspension, instead of a double suspension like the Golden Gate. And crews had to build a structure around that big tower to temporarily hold the road deck until last November. That's when the full weight of the bridge was transferred to the suspension system.
You know, we used a big left coast lifter. Some of you might have seen it out there in the bay, huge crane.
A huge crane floating on a huge barge.
That we use to lift like 300-foot sections at a time. You know, they weighed about from about 2 million pounds, 2 to 2.5 million pounds. And we'll hoist that in the air and we'll, you know, you find a hole and you spud it, pin it, and try to make bolts in it as fast as you can.
The ironworkers did other things too, like spinning the suspension cables and unbolting the equipment used to lift the tower sections into place. Cochran shows me a picture of himself, suspended in midair, holding what looks like a big drill.
And that is, if you look at the very, very top of the tower, I'm hanging off a positioning hook. There's nothing underneath me right there. And I'm taking this lifting lug off. That's how big the lug is, just to lift up that tower section. But that's what we do. I'm hanging off my ass there with nothing underneath me.
How high are you right now?
That's 538 feet.
Oh, my God.
That's part of the rigging. That's the shackles right there. And I'm just hanging by a position hook.
Were you ever scared of being that high, like at the beginning or now?
You don't think about it.
You guys aren't, but I am.
You know, it's not something you think about. You just, you know, you see something you got to do, you go do it.
Being an iron worker is dangerous. On average, 15 are killed each year nationwide. So far, no one has died working on the New Bay Bridge, but Cabala Jr. says that's rare for a project this big.
We're built to walk on iron. You know, not everybody can do our job, but they've got us so restrained by safety cables and lanyards and 100% tie-off that it's, when you're moving iron that's so big, it can move so fast that you can't get out of the way, and you're in sometimes in more of a risk of not being able to move quick enough out of the way before it actually you catches your arm in there and just, you know, cuts your arm off or whatever.
And there are distractions. Out on the bridge, the iron workers get an up-close view of wildlife, like diving pelicans and the peregrine falcons who live under the Old Bay Bridge. Batiste tells me they're actually trying to move the birds over to the new bridge before their nests are demolished.
I talked to one of the other iron workers one day, and he said, man, I was out here on a Sunday building birds' nests. I'm like, well, so tell me about this. And he started telling me about the birds that they're trying to coax over to the new bridge.
So far, it's not working.
The birds are like, we didn't build that house.
All three guys agreed the Bay Bridge is the hardest job they have ever worked. But it does pay well. They get an average rate of $33 an hour. Plus, they all worked overtime every day since the project started in 2008. That's about $140,000 a year. You can't just become an iron worker, though. First, you have to go to school, then take a 4-year apprenticeship at half pay. Only 20% of people who go into that make it out. As Cochran says, money isn't enough to make workers stick around.
There's been lots of close calls, and you know, but it's a close call and you shake it off and you keep moving. You know, we've all been hurt, you know. And I mean, when our workers get hurt, they get hurt. They look like this in slings. You know, I didn't have a right bicep anymore. You know, things like that, broken fingers and constant broken hands and feet and cut and beat up and just keep stepping.
Despite all that, Batiste says there's an enormous sense of pride in being able to look up and point to a massive engineering marvel like the Bay Bridge that he helped build.
It's going to be just like the Golden Gate Bridge, or they're going to say many generations of family members worked on that bridge long ago. What'd they say? That bridge is supposed to last 135 years, something like that.
It could happen. And that would mean these guys' great-great-great-great-grandchildren could drive over the bridge these men helped build. For Cross Currents, I'm Isabel Angel.
You can see the pictures taken by iron workers, including the one Cochran was talking about, where he's suspended more than 500 feet in the air, at our website, klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Iron workers employed by American Bridge built the new span. They also built the old one. But times have changed, and so has the design. While the soaring single suspension tower is striking, some people who know the bridge best lament what we're losing.
It's going to be a beautiful bridge when it's all said and done, but I'm going to miss this.
Richard Moradian of Manteca has had various jobs on the bridge since he started in 1978. These days, he's a structural steel welder.
I'm a blue-collar kind of person, and this is a blue-collar bridge. The other one is more like for Hollywood. I hate to say that, but that's the only way I can put it.
The long-promised near Labor Day opening appears to be on track again, but uncertainties over the quality of construction have dampened the possibility of a Hollywood-style premiere for that blockbuster of an eastern span. It wasn't that way in 1936, when the opening of the brand new bridge followed 5 days of celebrations. A live NBC radio broadcast of the dedication and opening described it as
the largest, longest, and greatest completed highway bridge in the world. Our broadcast came to you by means of ultra-high-frequency shortwave from the NBC mobile unit en route across the bridge.
KALW's Stephen Short is going to take us back in time to tell us the story behind the original Bay Bridge.
The first recorded suggestion of a bridge across the bay was by San Francisco's most beloved eccentric, Emperor Norton I, self-proclaimed Emperor of the United States and Protector of Mexico. He issued this decree, which appeared in the Pacific Appeal newspaper on March 23, 1872.
The following is decreed and ordered to be carried into execution as soon as convenient. That a suspension bridge be built from Oakland Point to Goat Island and then to Telegraph Hill, provided such bridge can be built without injury to the navigable waters of the Bay of San Francisco.
It would be more than 60 years before Emperor Norton's idea became reality. Design plans were led by State Highway Engineer Charles Purcell, with construction beginning July 8, 1933. The main contractor was the American Bridge Company of Pennsylvania, the same company that built the Empire State and Chrysler buildings in New York. Critics said it was an impossible task, but the project was a welcome endeavor. A worker in the 1930s, in the Great Depression, was grateful for any kind of steady employment.
I don't think there was the animosity today about government programs.
Greg Bayall is a retired public information officer for the Bay Bridge. He held that position from the mid-1980s until 2004.
Name a program and somebody's there immediately to put it down. Yeah. And I think at that time it was kind of accepted that, you know, this is what government did for you. You know, they built things so that it make your life better.
Building the bridge was extremely difficult work, and it was dangerous, even deadly. At least 28 workers died during construction.
A lot of people lost their lives on that bridge. It was unbelievable.
Evelyn Rhodes of Livermore, interviewed in 2012 at the age of 97, remembers when her father worked on the bridge.
There's no safety nets or nothing. People have no idea how bad things could get years ago, you know, because there's nothing to protect you. If you were working class, you were doomed. They figure you're either going to get killed or you're going to die falling off of something.
Work was continuous then, too, all day and all night. There were safety measures, but not as stringent as today.
American Bridge built the suspension span, and they required their people to wear a leather safety hat.
Chuck Syme, a retired maintenance engineer, didn't help build the bridge, but remembers talking with people who did.
And if you look at pictures, you'll see people with leather safety hats and bareheaded people, because there was no enforcement.
Photos depict workers walking above the bay on unsecured wooden planks. Remember, the roadbed is about 190 feet above the water. And you can add another 300 feet or so to the top of the towers on the west span. Those leather safety hats that Syme mentions looked like football helmets of that era and would not have provided much protection. And for the record, current style hard hats were also available. But there was another danger beyond the lack of safety enforcement.
See, there was this machoism. You know what I mean. Yeah, if you showed any kind of fright, boy, they'll drum you off the bridge.
This macho man attitude even extended to Governor Frank Merriam. While cutting the chains to open the bridge on November 12, 1936, he refused to put on safety glasses.
Governor Merriam is taking the assessment torch in his hand, having put on some gloves. He won't put on the glasses, evidently. There's a bit of delay, although for safety's sake, the glasses should be put on.
Safety glasses or no, the impossible task was finished, and half a year ahead of schedule at that. More than 8,000 men worked to build that bridge. Total cost, $77 million. That's equivalent to nearly $1.4 billion in today's dollars, or about one-fifth of what it's costing for the new project. Again, former public information officer Greg Bayall.
It was incredible. There was nothing that came near it. And you could say, I mean, when I answered the phone at my job, and people have a question about the bridge, and you could tell them, it's the longest bridge in the world.
Several bridges surpass that record today, even if you include both the east and west spans of the Bay Bridge. But its significance for that time remains untarnished. In 1955, the American Society of Civil Engineers selected the Bay Bridge as one of the 7 modern civil engineering wonders of the United States. For Cross Currents, I'm Stephen Short.
The remembrances you heard in this story were recorded in 2012 for a project coordinated by the Oakland Museum, Caltrans, and the Regional Oral History Office of UC Berkeley's Bancroft Library. Have you got any stories to share about the Bay Bridge? We'd like to hear them. You can call us and leave us a message at 415-264-7106. That number again to leave us a message is 415-264-7106, and we'll try to put your story on the air. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. When you think of suspension bridges, the first two that come to mind may be right here, the Bay Bridge and the Golden Gate Bridge. But after this next story, there's another that may stay with you, a suspension bridge in the state of Washington called the Tacoma Narrows Bridge. We'll share that story with you as related by Roman Mars in this edition of 99% Invisible.
The thing about being wrong is that before you know you're wrong, it feels exactly like being right.
If we knew that we were wrong, we wouldn't be wrong. Nobody's committing intentionally to a false belief about the world. If they are, they're not wrong. They're deliberately lying.
Even during the construction of the original Tacoma Narrows Bridge, which was to become the 3rd longest suspension bridge in the world, it seemed like something was wrong. Well, at least in hindsight, it seems like it should have felt that way. But that's not how being wrong works.
If you grew up like I did watching the Warner Brothers cartoons.
This is Catherine Schultz, author of Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error.
The Sunday morning cartoon moment where the roadrunner is dashing off the cliff and the coyote is following him. And of course the roadrunner can fly and the coyote can't. And there's this great moment where he's run off the cliff, but he has not yet realized that, you know, there's no solid ground underneath him. And the moment when we're wrong about something, but before we've realized it, is like that moment. We think that our belief is rock solid. We think we have, you know, all of the facts in the world bolstering us.
We feel like our giant suspension bridge is not going to collapse.
We have not yet looked down and realized that, whoops, that's not the case.
I know this sounds crazy, but even during its construction, the deck of the Tacoma Narrows Bridge would go up and down by several feet with the slightest breeze. Construction workers on the span chewed on lemon wedges to stop motion sickness. But construction continued because the bridge had been designed specifically to withstand winds up to 120 miles per hour. So everyone thought everything would be fine. Well, almost everyone. The original Tacoma Narrows Bridge design by Clark Eldridge was pretty conventional for a suspension bridge, but it was later modified by Leon Moisseiff to be slimmer and more elegant. The most notable change was the 25-foot lattice of stiffening trusses underneath the bridge on the original drawings were replaced with an 8-foot solid steel plate girder. The new solid girder along the side in Moisseiff's design made for a much lighter, slimmer, and more flexible bridge. It also caught the wind like a sail, but they didn't know that. Moisseiff's design was also 2/3 the price of the original Eldridge design, and that fact ultimately won the day. Eldridge and other state engineers were said to have protested, but it didn't matter. The original Tacoma Narrows Bridge opened to the public on July 1st, 1940.
From the day it opened, it was prone to having these oscillations, these longitudinal waves of the bridge deck.
That's our master of disaster, John Marr.
And I write on various murders and disasters and other sundry topics.
He used to publish a zine called Murder Can Be Fun about these sundry topics. He wrote about the Tacoma Narrows Bridge years ago.
The Workers on the bridge had nicknamed it Galloping Gertie, and that, you know, quickly kind of became the bridge's unofficial name.
Even light winds caused the roadway to ripple with longitudinal waves some 5 feet high.
The state of Washington was concerned about this, but not, like, intensely so. They were, like, looking at various things to reduce the motion. They had tried some tie-down cables and installing a damper and various other things, none of which had worked.
But again, the roadbed seemed like it could handle the waves just fine.
They're very confident in the structural integrity of the bridge.
The bridge was as solid as the air underneath Wile E. Coyote's feet. When you watch film of the waves traveling down the bridge, it is stunning. And the fact that the bridge stayed open at all really illustrates how local governments have changed since 1940. That thing would never stay open today. If you were sitting in a car on the bridge when the waves were going, the cars in front of you would bob up and then disappear completely from view.
Almost like a thrill ride. People would actually drive specifically for the feeling of riding on this bouncing bridge.
The ride ended just 4 months later.
Dawn of a fatal day, and the wind begins to speak with a roar that no man can fail to hear.
It was clear early on the morning of November 7th that the gale force winds were having a greater effect on the bridge than ever before.
Previously, these sorts of waves on the bridge had been, like, you know, fairly transitory. You know, you'd bounce up for a couple minutes, but this was just going on and on, so they thought this could be problematical. Although they had seen actually deeper waves on the bridge.
But then the movement changed.
Things, you know, just got worse.
The bridge began to twist violently along the center line.
And that became, like, extremely violent. One end of the bridge deck was up at a 45-degree angle.
In a 40-mile-an-hour gale, the center span weaves like a ribbon in a swinging twist that you wouldn't believe possible as the bridge gyrates like a nightmare high above the river, twisting, turning, curling.
By this time, everyone had gotten off. The blunt, solid edge of the bridge disrupted the flow of the strong wind, causing one part to twist up while the other section twisted down. And it continued this torsional back and forth for over an hour, so there was plenty of time for spectators to come watch, including the bridge's original designer, Clark Eldridge. A local camera store owner named Barney Elliott arrived on the scene and took the now-famous color film of the bridge's relentless gyrations.
No structure of steel and concrete can stand such a strain. Steel girders buckle and giant cables snap like puny threads. There it goes! Engineers are divided as to the cause of the disaster. Some claim it was the use of solid girders. Others differ. But whatever the reason, Tacoma will rebuild. This time a bridge that will not provide a super thrill in the news.
Before the collapse, bridge aerodynamics and structural failure due to torsion had scarcely been considered. Or maybe those lessons had been lost in the rapid evolution of more and more slender and longer bridges. But the failure caused the study of bridge aerodynamics to take off, and any bridges that were on the drawing board in 1940 were redesigned with more conservative, deep open truss deck structures. The lead designer, Leon Moisef, and his solid steel I-beams received most of the blame for the disaster. He never designed another bridge again, due in no small part to the fact that he died 3 years later.
No one was killed on the bridge. A few people were very lucky to get away with their lives because I just imagine you're on this bridge and it's twisting at a 45-degree angle and you're trying to walk off in a fairly stiff wind. The only casualty was a dog.
A local newspaper man named Leonard Coatsworth drove his car just past the East Tower when the twisting started.
It got bouncing so hard he couldn't control his car anymore.
The tilting bridge threw his car into the side curb.
And he had his daughter's dog, a Cocker Spaniel named Tubby, with him.
Coatsworth gets out of his wrecked vehicle and gets thrown face down on the curb.
The dog's completely freaked out. He couldn't get the dog out.
He hears the concrete cracking beneath him.
And he barely makes it to safety.
An engineering professor studying the bridge named Farquharson ventured out to get Tubby right when the bridge was about to fall into the sound. But when he reached into the car, Tubby bit him. The dog was just too freaked out to leave the vehicle. There's amazing film of Farquharson stumbling back as best he could, sticking to that middle yellow line as the bridge rocked wildly along its center axis.
So Tubby was the only casualty, and, you know, the poor guy was said, you know, God, I have to tell my daughter this.
Coatsworth was quoted immediately after the collapse saying, With real tragedy, disaster, and blasted dreams all around me, I believe that right at this minute, what appalls me most is that within a few hours I must tell my daughter that her dog is dead when I might have saved him.
That's Roman Mars, who makes the stories for 99% Invisible, along with Sam Greenspan. You can hear them all by clicking on programs at klw.org, which is also where you can subscribe to the Cross Currents podcast. That's it for today's Cross Currents from KLW News. Our team includes Audrey Dilling, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Christina Loring, Alyssa Kapnick, Chris Hoff, Leela Day, Daniel Moore, and Ray Sue Sussman. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And thanks to you, KLW is independent, listener-supported radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.